Good day, listeners, to the Oil Ground Up podcast. This is Tony Greer, TG Macro. I'm here with Dirk Hesseman, my man, a well plug and abandonment engineer in the Asia Pacific region. Dirk, how are you doing today, bro?
Hey, I'm doing good, Tony. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking the time to come on the podcast. I thought you'd be a really, really interesting guest. For the listeners that can't see you, Dirk is kind of like the Kiefer Sutherland from 24 of the Asia Pacific region. He's got a very specialized, very exciting job of well plug and abandonment, which is the job of decommissioning wells what they're essentially at the end of their life. There's so many angles we can take on this, Dirk, but why don't you tell me essentially what that process is like?
Yeah, so when a well reaches the end of its life, it generally, after that, sits for a long period of time because operators don't want to spend the money to plug the well until they actually have to. And generally, that's forced by the regulators. So when it comes time to actually do the work, assuming, you know, an offshore well, you have to line up the resources. We could go way technical here, but I'm going to try not to do that. If I am going too technical, step in.
Nah, keep it all for layman's terms, man. You know how it is with us.
So you get the resources and you go out and you access the well and basically you install cement plugs in the well at various levels until you've got the requisite barriers in place to remove everything from the environment.
Now, these are all offshore wells that you're working on, correct?
Yes. The work I do right now is focusing only on offshore.
So you make it sound very casual that you just kind of lop in, you know, you kind of pop over to this well and this thing is like 60 to 80 meters deep under the sea sometimes, right? How do you get down there?
Well, so the last project I was on, the wells were, like you said, roughly, you know, 60 to 80 meters below the surface of the water. They can vary from wells sticking above the surface of the water to wells that are, 200 or 2,000, 3,000 meters below the seafloor. So to access them, the work we were doing was, the term is rigless, and it's obviously that means without using a rig. That's the niche I focus on in oil and gas. The work we did was using a big boat with a crane, wow, and two ROVs, remote operated vehicles, which are basically like a big underwater robot about the size of a Volkswagen that has the ability to go down below the water and replace a diver, essentially, and do the work that, you know, a diver or team of divers would normally do.
So this thing's got arms on it, I guess, that you can operate. Is that right?
The ROVs generally have two arms. They call them manipulators, and the ability to run hydraulics and electrical functions.
Wow. Okay, so now you send this thing down there. You're in control of it, so it's obviously got a camera on it.
It's got a few cameras, yeah.
Right.
A few cameras and lights and, yeah.
So you're essentially doing arthroscopic surgery on this well now. And tell us a little bit more explicitly about the procedure. Now, I understand that there's like a succession of casings on the well. Does that come into play? Or is that just when you're repairing those? Like, how does that play into a well closure?
Yeah, so the work I was doing, the wells were previously abandoned by a rig. They were actually exploration wells where, you know, the operator was going out and trying to find hydrocarbons, and they, you know, that process involves them drilling exploration wells. Some of them are commercial, some of them are not. These wells were deemed non-commercial. They were abandoned at the time, and which involved setting plugs in the innermost casing. And these were drilled quite some time ago, anywhere from, I think, the 70s through the 90s. So the philosophy on abandonment at the time, back in the 70s, may not have been the same as what it is now. So as you alluded to, there's when a well is constructed, there's a series of different sizes of casings which form annuli. And you have to make sure there's barriers in these annuli before you finish the abandonment of a well. So these wells, there was either lacking barriers in one or more annuli, or the barriers had failed. So the operator had determined there was gas in the one or more annulus. So we had to figure out a way to access them and bleed off the gas and install a barrier. So we came up with a methodology and technology to do this using ROVs, where in the past you would either have to use a rig to go in from the inside and work your way out. We chose to go with ROV tooling, and essentially it's a multi-string hot tap, which hot tapping is a very familiar term in the oil field and other industries, where you're
tell us about that. You're
just drilling into a live pipe is what it involves. So we would make a seal on the outside of the pipe. We would drill into it to access the annulus inside, and then do our intervention work, which was often just bleeding off any pressure, any gas to surface, basically with a very long hose that we would run from the boat. And then through that same hose, then we could pump cement into the well. And then, assuming there was multiple annuli, once we finished one and had it isolated, then we would proceed into the next annulus inside.
So. Gotcha. So you said you plugged the wells with cement, regular cement, like road cement?
So that's concrete that goes into building roads.
What's this like?
So it's basically very similar. It's cement. So it doesn't have the rock, the aggregate that is used to make concrete. So it's basically, concrete without the little rocks. So it's a lot finer. And there's, there's people whose entire careers are centered around cement in the oil field. So it can be very complex depending on the wells and what you're doing. But for the work we were doing, it was very a lot more basic, with some issues with pumping through small orifices when we're drilling into the annuli. So.
Gotcha. Is that the only thing that's used to plug wells, is cement? Like, that's the most technical thing? Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, that's definitely the most common. They do have some polymers that are used in more specialized situations, some resins and stuff, but that's not typically used. No, cement is cheap and effective. And... yeah, you can pump a lot of it and form a very, very good barrier.
So, Dirk, I may have a couple of dumb questions here, but why are wells plugged? Like, what's the risk if you leave one unplugged, or are they left unplugged, or what causes an E&P company to go back and say, hey, let's plug those up, or give us a little information on that lane.
Well, so no, you definitely, the wells definitely need plugged once they reach the end of their useful life. It's a conduit from the formation where the hydrocarbons are to the environment. And whether that's, offshore, to the sea, or onshore, you have, freshwater aquifers and things like that, where obviously you don't want hydrocarbons migrating where they're not supposed to be. It's a regulatory requirement in, I think, probably all jurisdictions, to at the end of the well's life, you you're required to plug it. And some jurisdictions are much more prescriptive in how you go about doing that and the timing, and then others are much more loose.
Gotcha. And you provide really bespoke solutions, right? An E&P company will hire you and your company and say, we've got a bunch of wells to plug up, and you'll be like, okay, this is how we're going to do this. And that procedure will be on you, kind of thing. Or they hire you expecting a specific procedure, or is it just a relationship business why they hire you?
A lot of it's, you know, relationship. I focus on rigless intervention for these wells, where my goal is to save operators money. Rigs are expensive, and, you know, for the most part, they should be focused. The operators should use them for revenue generating work. And so by saying, hey, you know, we can find another way to do that same work with assets that are have a much lower cost and, you know, potential overall exposure, you know, from its, whether it's, you know, health and safety or cost. So it's, the industry is recognized the value in these rigless solutions. And yeah, being able to provide these to the operators, that's what I enjoy doing. And it's more, you know, talking to the operators, seeing what problems they have and saying, hey, we can fix this for you. We can fix this for you cheaper than what you might have originally thought.
Yeah. Let me get a little granular with that. Like, say, you know, how long does it take to plug up a well? You know, I'm trying to just give our listeners a sense of the size and scope of your business. Like, how long does it take to plug up, you know, either a well or a group of wells, and sort of how many, you know, how many can you do in a year? You know, does your company do like 2 to 10, or do you do like 20 to 100 a year, you know?
Yeah. So the operators, you know, they, let's see how, the best way to answer this. You can do there, I guess there's so much, so many different flavors of wells. It's hard to say, okay, it takes this long to plug a well. It could be, you know, from a well that hasn't been touched to a final P&A, to where everything's cut and removed and, you know, the work is completed. You never have to go back. It could be, you know, 10 to 14 days.
Really?
There's train wrecks that, you know, make that, skew that much longer sometimes. And some of them, you know, are just a simpler well construction, and they go pretty quick. So there's a lot of different variations to that.
I'm interested in the train wrecks. What's it like when something goes horribly wrong, Dirk?
So these wells that we're working on, oftentimes sit for a really, really long time. Operators aren't, unless there's a regulatory driver forcing them to do work, generally operators don't want to do well P&A, because it doesn't make them money, obviously. Now there certainly has been a shift in the majors, to where they recognize they've got to clean as they go, and they've been proactive. But for the most of these wells that we've worked on in the past, you know, decade, they've sat for sometimes longer than I've been on this planet. You can imagine, you know, a hunk of steel sitting in a marine environment for, you know, a couple decades, the conditions of a well just, they can get pretty bad. So when you're trying to go from the surface down to maybe, you know, 10,000, 15,000 feet below the ground in something that's been sitting there inactive for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you can imagine the difficulties that you might encounter. Corrosion and
yeah. Like, you know, have you encountered, like, have you been handed jobs, Dirk, that you take a look at and you're like, oh my God, like, what, how the hell are we going to get this done? Really? Like, what's that like?
It's exciting. Because anybody can do the easy ones. It's the challenging ones that really make you tick and kind of keep you in the game. That's really where you can show value to the operators as well, saying, hey, we can find a way to do this that's going to be a lot less painless than you originally thought. But sometimes that's not the case also. It's these wells, in the worst cases, the operators have to drill essentially what you would consider to be a relief well to intersect the well bore and isolate it that way.
Dirk, is that right?
Come in with another angle and intersect the well bore with essentially a new well to access the formation to isolate it. So that would be probably the most extreme case. But there's a lot of different tools that can be used before you get to that point.
Gotcha. So it is not, there aren't too many dire circumstances like that.
No. Fortunately. Gotcha.
Now, can you tell how big is this market? I mean, you said that a lot of it, some of it is regulation driven. So obviously there's a sort of natural flow to the market sort of every year. I would imagine certain E&P companies have a number of wells that come up that need to be plugged and abandoned, et cetera. And kind of you're the guy for that. Like, is there a handle on quantifying that market in any region or anything like that, just to give listeners some kind of idea?
Well, so yeah, recently I was in Australia, meeting with some clients, and decommissioning in general, which involves well P&A and removal of facilities. There was a lot of figures thrown about, with many folks saying over the next, decade or so, they're forecasting something like $50 billion in decommissioning activity. I think that was just in Australia alone. So you hear these figures quite a bit in the industry. They'll say, $30 billion in the North Sea over the next 10 years. It's in the billions, and each region has its own figure that's similarly high. Over the last decade, decommissioning has really become a bigger topic in the oil field, with the recognizing that this clean as you go philosophy is taken hold with all the majors.
Yeah, you would wonder if the environmental movement would have a sort of impact on that and sort of, up the schedule with which you've got to kind of clean up as you go. It's kind of an interesting business. It's kind of, backward looking maintenance. Right. So it's like that kind of business that's just kind of hard to pay attention to. When you're trying to go forward, it's hard to look backward on the wells and say, oh, man, we got to go back and clean up that mess that we pulled all the oil out from. Right.
Yeah. It's from the operator perspective, it's tough. When things are booming, they want to focus all their resources on, finding more hydrocarbons and producing more.
Yeah.
And then when things go bust, as that's the cycle in the oil field, they claim that they don't have the money to do the work. So, they don't have the budget. So that's how the work easily kind of gets pushed to the side. And then, all of a sudden you wake up and you're like, oh, I've got a bunch of these wells I need to plug. But yeah, so regulations have changed in the last, decade or so, and more jurisdictions are forcing the operators to do this work on a time frame.
So your industry looks like it could be a growth industry. Is that fair to say, or is that, I don't know, I would imagine that it could be something that the world is paying a little bit more attention to.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
where do you see it going? Or an easier question, Dirk, like how do you see it progressing over the next half decade to a decade, something like that?
Well, I mean, so all these wells that have been drilled, all these offshore all the offshore infrastructure, all the pipelines, every bit of that is going to need to be removed at some point. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it. So I think there's going to be quite over the next, 30, 40, 50 years, there's still going to be a lot of work. I think enough work to where another generation can easily retire in the oil field. And that's, I guess, brings up another issue is, one of the things I'm hearing quite a bit now is there's no people to do the work.
I can imagine. I was just going to say that is probably, it's probably a tough sell. It's probably a tough sell to college kids. It's probably a tough sell to engineers. There's probably a million sexier jobs that they could choose or, things like that. So I totally get it.
Yeah, we had a pretty nasty downturn, from 2015, 2014, 2015 timeframe. And that pushed a lot of people out of the business. And, it's going to take a while for a lot of them to return, and some of them won't. And you have it in the meantime, you have all the baby boomers, they call it, the great crew change, where all the baby boomers are retiring from the industry, which, the industry has been heavily weighted towards those, baby boomers. It's interesting times.
Yeah, the great crew change, man. It's really interesting. It kind of rhymes with the fact that like Major League Baseball's, the age of average Major League Baseball fans now is 57 nowadays. Yeah. And that just blew my mind, man. It's like it feels like you kind of grew up in the kind of age of the average player kind of grew with you. Man, this is a really interesting conversation, Dirk, about a really interesting field. I mean, I know that I can tell young kids that there is a growth industry in well plug and abandonment. Certainly if they're looking for a job, and I could probably have them contact you. I'm curious, do you have, because I always care about market opinions, from your position, in the Asia Pacific, operating, in subsea submersibles on wells, do you have a view on the oil markets or oil and gas or on price of any of that? Do you see any of things developing that concern you or anything like that, Dirk?
No, nothing, certainly nothing concerning. I think, all indications are commodities prices will stay pretty firm. And I think with, given the amount of activity that needs to be done, I think oil field service companies are going to continue to claw back from the hole they found themselves in after the downturn from 2015. Starting to see indications that service companies are being able to wrangle back some ground from the operator supply chains, which is good to see. Some of the pricing firm up, and with the shortage of personnel, that's going to firm up personnel rates pretty good. So, I think things are going to continue at least over the next decade to be pretty good. I think there's going to be a good, consistent level of activity.
Yeah, it's good to hear, because to me, the oil services sector trades like a sector that has bottomed and, is struggling to get off the mat, but it's always interesting to see the flows. And this year, there's just been massive inflow into technology and outflow largely from commodities and specifically from energy. And I think it lines up with, where we are in this administration, and there's just been so little new investment in new drilling and things like that because of the administration's posture. So it does stand to reason that, if the gasoline demand, remains static to higher or growth is steady, that, the industry is due for, a full upswing in investment in drilling and exploration and things like that. And then hopefully an entire upswing in success where the stocks will continue to perform. And, and hopefully we can be a part of that rally. And I think it's a really interesting space to continue following. So listen, Dirk, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast today from all the way around the world. I think this is a really, really interesting sort of subsector of the oil and gas markets that, like you said, it's really, it was really intriguing for me to kind of, you know, drill down into this, you know, like we said, sector of a sector and find such an interesting, you know, potentially really big growth story. So that was really cool. And thanks for sharing it with us, Dirk.
Yeah, you're welcome. Welcome.
Yeah, so we'll have you on again. We'll have you on the show again in a couple of years and see how the business is going and see if anything dramatic has changed in the oil markets. But I can't thank you enough for coming on and discussing what you do with us here today.
Yeah, I look forward to chatting with you again, and welcome to do it anytime.
Thank you so much, Dirk. And just closing down for the Oil Ground Up podcast, this is Tony Greer. Thank you very much.